I'll find them for myself.
I think one of the things that we can obviously see, I hope we can obviously see, is that this quality which we are calling metta, translated in this way that I've been translating it today as friendliness, kindness as well, it implies both, is something that's sorely needed in this world. It's sorely needed in our lives, isn't it? I'm not talking about all the conflicts and all of the wars and all of the terrible physical situations we find in them. Obviously that calls for it. But I'm just thinking about our ordinary, everyday lives. Yeah. Often our lives are so busy, they have not a lot of time for kindness to either self or other. Yeah, to friendliness to self or other. We can sometimes get away with a bit of politeness, being British. We can get away with a bit of politeness, but as Henry James once said about one of his characters in his novel, I think it's The Wings of the Dove, when he says he was polite to the point of brutality. Which I think is a lovely expression, isn't it? Yeah. That's often how it can be used. But sort of humour aside, this is something that, as you can hear, and I'll read just the brief passage again in a few minutes, as you can hear, this is something that needs constant recollection from the Buddha's point of view. It gets so easily lost. I would suggest, and I'll leave you to think about it, because that's all really I'm trying to do, is just to stimulate you to think about this in your life, and hopefully to encourage you to practice some of it in your life, is that somehow we lose something of our humanity when we lose that ability to be kind even to oneself. We lose something, don't we? Very strongly. We lose even the capacity, in the Buddha's terms, to start to develop compassion in a very rounded sense. Now again, I was sharing with the group yesterday, these days I don't even translate karuna as compassion, but as kindness born out of friendliness. It's kindness which emerges out of the friendliness that one feels for self and other. It's almost as if it arises more spontaneously once you have that groundedness in friendliness. Without that soil and without us cultivating that soil, because that's what we're doing, and be aware that the Buddha's teaching is full of these horticultural, agricultural metaphors. Those were the people he was talking to. He was talking to an agrarian society 2,500 years ago a lot of the time. And he's using metaphors which would make sense. They're about growing things, cultivating things, weeding, tending, looking after. You don't plant your seed and then go and forget about it, because it just dies. And I would say that's true even of the seeds of friendliness and the seeds of kindness, and eventually, of course, what we're going to call karuna. These will wither and die unless we actually, in a sense, tend them, care for them, recollect them, come into remembrance of those qualities that we have. Sometimes we can be pulled up very short, and sometimes often perhaps encounter, these are just sort of thoughts about this, we can be pulled up short when we encounter kindness to ourselves by another. It can be very moving, can't it? When literally we're touched by another, I don't necessarily mean physically, but it's almost as if somebody has touched us physically when they've paid attention, when they have actually focused or listened to you, responded to you rather than reacted. All of these things. And all of these are born of that kindness, of that metta. And as we've seen with the practice, and as you know, just on the practice we've done, and we'll do another session before we finish today, the Buddha feels this is rooted initially in being kinder, more accepting towards oneself. Yeah. Not to do it above others, but to do it equally. Again, I don't want to make overgeneralizations, but I tend to think often in the Western world we're much more focused on doing stuff for others than we do for ourselves. And I think a lot of people, particularly in caring professions, professions where you're working with people, know the consequences of that. Because at some time, there's this phrase that we get, which seems to be so common in our world these days, which is burnout. And there's nothing left to give. And why in a sense shouldn't that happen? Because if you haven't resourced yourself, if you haven't topped up the tank in some way, then you are going to run on empty after a while. And running on empty, a bit like an engine that's got no oil in it, it will just grind to a halt. There's nothing to oil the motion, to keep the wheels turning, to keep our interactions with others really engaged, in a sense. So what I'm really trying to say to you, and this is the really, I think, if you don't take anything else away these days, kindness towards yourself, metta developed in this way, friendliness towards the difficulties that you encounter. The difficulty is actually for that moment and that snapshot that you sit in meditation or do it in a much more informal way is you. You might not like it, but it is you at that moment. At that moment, and that's a really important thing, because it doesn't have to be at the next moment. Because there's change. We are process. We are nothing other than that process. And this is the thing I really wanted you to take away. This is not self-indulgence. From the Buddha's perspective, from the perspective of this ancient tradition, this is an absolute necessity, and we forget it, and we forget something of ourselves. That is why it's a mindfulness. Yeah. Mindfulness is about remembering. It's about recollecting. You know, derived, as most people will know, because again, it's often talked about and probably talked about a lot in these meditation days, if you come to them regularly, that mindfulness is a recollection. It's actually derived from a root in the original language meaning to remember something rather than forget. So we can live in a state of constant forgetfulness. And remember, our societies and the speed of our societies often militates against remembering. Yeah. Other than the next task that we have to be engaged in. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, we're often so task-orientated and focused that we forget to do even what I call the bare necessities of kindness for ourselves. And then, of course, we forget it for others. Or we focus on others if we're in the caring profession and forget totally about ourselves in that relationship. And I think that our societies really, really do militate against that. And I don't think it's just Western society. I think it's the world as it is now. It's come to dominate as a zeitgeist through the world. That is the way that it functions. And there's a very telling, and some of you might have even heard this, heard me read it before. There's a very telling little quotation from a Western author, not from a Buddhist source at all, because we can find inspiration from other sources other than just Buddhist sources. And it's by the author Milan Kundera. Some of you might know his work. He wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which he said he would never write a book again that could be filmed. but he wrote this. It's out of his reflections on the art of the novel. He says, speed, the demon of speed, is often associated with forgetting. hope that resonates with what I've just said, with avoidance. Slowness is associated with memory and with confronting. We move slowly when we want to listen to ourselves. We move slowly when we want to listen to others and the world around us. We move slowly when we want to accept ourselves. The rush of contemporary life overwhelms us all, and our ability to observe, to hear, to step back and to wonder. Society sadly wants to blow out the tiny trembling flame of memory. It's quite a telling indictment of our societies, isn't it? It even wants to, just going back to the quote, it stops our ability to step back and wonder, and perhaps putting it in more terms you're familiar with, even terms I've used today, to be curious and interested in what's going on for you. Other than it, when it becomes overwhelming and you can't avoid it. Sadly, that's often what motivates people to do something, isn't it? When they get overwhelmed, they find themselves in a position of having to, seek medication or something for problems that they have. But we don't have to get to that position. And even if we do find ourselves in this position, there are ways that we can resource ourselves. I'm not saying this is the only way, but it's obviously, I hope it's been obvious from today, from even the brief things I've said, and obviously this is such an important way of beginning to do this. And whether we practice this formal, more formalized form that I've introduced you to, this way of listening and seeing how these phrases fall in our lives, whether we do that or not is not really the point. It's whether we, in a sense, even in our meditation practice, in our movement towards the things we're engaged in, because remember, meditation, cultivation, is actually for life. It's not for some abstruse sitting on a cushion in some mystical state. It's the ability to move from that cushion into life. And slowness, I think Kundera really pinpoints, doesn't have to be moving, even in the walking meditation, like the condemned. I often think that walking meditation, as I see it practiced in the West, ought to be done to the theme tune of Berlioz's March to the Scaffold. Because it often looks that way. Slowness is in the mind. Slowness is not with the speed with which you move, is it? And the speed with which you do things. So we can have this sense of stillness within. That's what we're accessing in this, is the stillness. To access that stillness needs a great deal of patience, and it needs a great deal of kindness for us to be able to act out from that stillness. With often, and I know this is the impossibility, isn't it? We can't, in a sense, move slowly, because often our lives, our job, our work, our professions demand us to be moving with speed, to be doing things with speed. So, to move, to get into a position where we can have those works, those professions that we're all engaged in, and not to have them overwhelm us, we have to resource ourselves to access that stillness, that we can then, in a sense, move from that stillness into often the speed which is demanding. So one can be moving, acting, doing things, often with the speeds that are demanded, but from a great sense of centeredness and stillness and kindness. That's, in a way, part of the task, isn't it, of what we're engaging in. This is, I think, wasn't necessarily there in the Buddha's time, and sometimes even when you go to India these days, things don't move that quickly, certainly in rural areas. But in our societies in the 21st century, we often require that skill. But we don't have to lose ourselves in the speed. Even if it's there, even if it's an intrinsic part about the way life has unfolded in the 21st century, whether we like it or not. We have to deal with it as it is, as we find ourselves in this world. And isn't that the message that comes through from all of this tradition? To deal with it as it is, not to just want to quickly change it. Yes, change will happen. Sometimes we have to agitate for change. We still have to make movements. This is not a recipe for simply disengagement and quietism. Change what we can be changed, but so much can't. It's out of our hands. I think this needs this great pool of friendliness and kindness towards ourselves and towards often the situations and the the difficulties we find ourselves encountering in day-to-day life. In our ordinary, average, everyday interactions with others. Yeah, as I say, I'm not talking about the big world situation. I think that that's obvious. What sometimes isn't so obvious to us is the conflict within our own situations. The wellsprings, in a sense, and I don't mean this in terms of physical violence, but the violence we do to ourselves and the violence we do to others in speech, in thought, sometimes in deed. And okay, there might not be the gross manifestations of violence that we see enacted on the world stage, but they're violence nonetheless, and actually that's what causes those violence, the conflicts that we see enacted on that big world stage. So we're really having to focus in and see metta and its components, because it doesn't just arise alone. It's a foundation, but it's supported, and it supports other qualities. In a way, a day like today, just isolating metta out from its other psychological components is a little artificial, because it goes with other components, such as the ability to develop attentiveness, the ability to begin to gather the mind, the ability out of that to move into responsiveness. And that responsiveness often goes under this huge name of compassion, doesn't it? And I think, I don't know about you, when I first heard that word compassion in Buddhist circles, yeah, I kind of understood what it was, but it seemed like, Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill. The only thing I was going to do is get squashed at the bottom, because it seems such an enormous task. Does it ever feel like that to people? And particularly in other traditions, sometimes in traditions like Tibetan tradition, it almost seems it's impossible. They talk about Maha Karuna. Not just compassion, the great compassion, the big compassion. Yeah, forget about your little bits of compassion. Just go for the big one. But what I want to do is naturalize it. Friendliness and its outgrowth of this kindness and its outgoing kindness is there in the little acts. Interestingly, it's relational. As teachers always used to say to me when I was in the East, actually, it's relational even when others are not around. Because somehow it's still engaged with thinking about others. It's that sense of relation. So, for example, I always remember this as an example, compassion, and I'm sure many of them might have even done this, it's not a big act, is it? But just taking a stone or a rock or a brick or a stick out of a path because somebody might trip over it. That's thinking about others. So it's, if we want to see the growth of this, it's not in huge things, it's in almost in the detail of our engagement with others, and sitting in silence and being aware that somebody might want the salt. I wouldn't put that on terms of maha karuna, but you know, it's thinking about being engaged, being friendly and kind to others. But coming back to the sense of developing metta for oneself is literally to befriend oneself. Literally to befriend oneself. It was interesting that when Eastern teachers first started arriving in the West, particularly in the late 60s, early 70s, that they were surprised, particularly those coming from Theravadan cultures, the southern forms of Buddhism, where metta is a distinct practice and the Brahmaviharas are a distinct practice, that they were shocked and quite surprised when they discovered that a lot of people living in the West really did not like themselves. Intrinsically, they didn't actually have a good relationship with themselves. It's almost like it's been educated into us. And so, you know, what is often, I mean, I remember this when I was living in Sri Lanka, and often what was this slightly little practice, which was developing metta towards self. Because it was taken for granted that you would like yourself, you know, in some way, was now having to be put forward as a primary foundation for the development of metta, simply because it wasn't there. It was so absent in contemporary experience that we even took time out to engage in looking what is good for us and what is good about us. Now, and this doesn't have to be self-adulatory. It doesn't have to be the stuff of Facebook pages. You know, this is appreciating what is good in one's life, what is valuable about your own sense of being, even. Because often that's what gets lost, is our value of our sense of being here, other than a role or a function. Notice how we often take on professions and roles and functions as identities that we hide behind, in a sense, the vacuousness of the sense of not being substantial enough. Does that gel with anybody's experience? So identity is like a mask that we're hiding behind, often in terms of a role that we can play and fulfill. And unfortunately, not just be that profession, that role, but end up being our identity in this. It's like losing ourselves in that. That's another act of forgetting. So when we talk about metta as a primary act of remembering to be kind to yourself, that doesn't mean being self-indulgent. You know, because again, being kind to ourselves, often in our contemporary languages, equates with being slightly self-indulgent, doesn't it? I think I'll go and be kind to myself and go shopping. Kind to myself and watch some television. As I often remark, you know, if one wants to see greed, aversion and delusion, just close your eyes. That's nothing to do with anything I've got against television, but often this is ways of losing ourselves. You know, and that kindness that we and friendliness that we're supposedly attributing in these activities are actually not. We're just losing ourselves in them. We're not remembering ourselves, gathering ourselves in some way. Now, gathering ourselves isn't always easy, and it's not always pleasant, is it? Yet think about the task. I know it's slightly I slightly joked about it this afternoon when we started off this afternoon session by saying, you know, this is not about falling asleep, it's about falling awake. You know? And that's actually the whole purpose of this, is to wake up. The whole purpose of the practice is to wake up. Yeah. Many different interpretations of that, but I won't go into that today. But it's to wake up. And just fundamentally, wake up to where you are, what's going on, how things are, and how I can respond to the life situations I find myself in, rather than sleepwalk our way through life. Yeah. In that act of forgetfulness. Yeah. As many of you will know, in the sort of secular mindfulness world, there's this wonderful phrase that we use, which is automatic pilot. It's a very useful phrase. It really does cover it. And so much of life is just automatic pilot. Switch it on in the morning and just stagger down the street. Do what we have to do. And it doesn't require any engagement. It's actually that primary sense of forgetfulness. So to engage in metta is to engage in a primary act of remembrance, but it's not always pleasant, because we're going to encounter that desire to want to forget and move away from that which is difficult and painful. This is more like, and here is the task, how can we be friendly and kind and incorporate everything that's difficult about our lives at this present moment into it, without wanting to push it away? That's in a sense the task. I hope it doesn't sound too big. I hope it doesn't sound like the Metta Karuna task, you know, the great compassion task. But that's really what the Buddha is talking about. How do we incorporate all of these aspects of our being, the difficulty as well as the ease, whatever ease that you might find in your life, whatever joys that you might find, rather than wanting to desperately cling to those moments, desperately, and that's what we do, isn't it? We somehow try to desperately cling to those moments to stop them fading away, because I somehow feel more real at that moment in time. More alive, more engaged, perhaps even more connected with people, and not be lost in the difficulties. And just sometimes it doesn't have to be huge traumas and tragedies and anything like that, just the grind of ordinary life, just the grind of going on from day to day. Yeah. In a way, it's a really good definition of dukkha, being ground down. But we're also engaged in the grinding down. It's not just happening to us externally, we do it to ourselves. We grind ourselves down in the attitudes that we bring and in the lack of resources that we develop for ourselves to be able to cope with this. It's understandable, and I'm not pointing an accusatory finger and saying this is wrong what we do. It's really understandable. It's a coping mechanism. That's what we're doing, isn't it? Most of us want to switch off because we want to cope with life in some way, instead of having it overwhelm us. And so we develop strategies and habits and mechanisms for coping with that. And, you know, when we say we're going to be kind to ourselves, we do all those things that I sort of slightly joked about. Things that actually don't resource us, really, in the end. And so, coming back to the theme of the day, kindness and metta, in this real sense of the word, is also that incorporation of the difficult. Yeah. That movement towards, again, it was a Sri Lankan friend of mine who I think I might have mentioned this morning, said, you know, befriending our monsters. Yeah. Moving and befriending our monsters, our demons that are there often for us, lurking in the background. We've pushed them away. Don't want to know about them. Beautiful definition of ignorance. I don't want to know about them. I want to ignore them. The Buddha says to do that is to feed it. Yeah? Just like we give the body nutrition by feeding it, keeping ourselves alive. If you want to keep a good repression going, keep it down. Keep it repressed. You will feed it. You will turn it into a monster. So this movement of metta, the movement that's being encouraged is the movement of softening and acceptance. Of moving to accept that which is really, really difficult and incorporate it in your life. Incorporate it from this moment. Now the reason for that, coming back to this waking up process, is the movement towards waking up is not just to wake up towards that which is good in your life, but to wake up towards everything so that we know how to respond. Now there's another huge dimension to it, which takes it onto a slightly bigger plane, which is it is actually the ground of the ethical. Developing that sense of responsiveness and the kindness that arises out of that friendliness. Now remember, this is nothing about liking stuff. It's not about that worst person in your life who winds you up. You still don't have to like them. that horrendous pain that you might have or thing that's happened to you that is there in your life and has been for a while, it's nothing about liking it. And it, in a way, wanting to avoid it, get rid of it, move away from it, is quite a natural movement. The Buddha is just saying it's unskillful. He's not saying it's wrong. He's just saying it's unskillful. We end up doing that thing of feeding it, feeding the problem. The more I don't engage with somebody in friendliness, the more I feed my dislike and aversion. So, movement towards somebody in friendliness is not to say I like you. And you don't have to like. That's not the task, in a way. And particularly when we look around and seeing what people do, often, we don't... And again, I'm not talking about the horrific things. I'm just talking about the ordinary, everyday, sometimes bad behaviour that we all engage in from time to time. That's that ordinary bad behaviour that we see. Slightly unethical behaviour in the way we treat each other and can be dismissive and slightly violent, in our speech, particularly in our thoughts as well. I mean, this is, in a sense, an ethical stance, isn't it? We're really starting to look at our ethical relations. So it's not about liking, because obviously I look around, I don't like some of my behaviour and I don't like others' behaviour. But I can still move towards it and try perhaps to befriend it, and in befriending it perhaps I understand it a little more. Again, I just want to check in. Does that kind of follow for you? I don't want to lose you in this. So we move towards it. Not with saying, I like this. This pain, this difficulty, this trauma, whatever it is. But we move towards it in a way of accepting and befriending and perhaps beginning to see how I can respond to this. It's in my life. I mean, this is where we start from, isn't it? These things are in our lives. And it's almost like saying, no, it's not there. Really, no. And not wanting to move towards it. So this is a movement. If we're thinking about it as a movement, there's a primary movement towards something. Whereas the psychology, which is founded on the unskillful, is generally a movement away from, turning inwards rather than outwards towards, if you want to use a sort of directionality about this. So if we think about this, particularly in relation, let's start off with relation to others. When I'm friendly, even if I find you difficult, I move towards you. Certainly when there is compassion, and again, not the big stuff, this huge task that often is presented. But when I move just in the sense of a basic kindness towards you as another human being with difficulties, often which are driving your behaviours. In other words, your dukkha often drives the behaviour that I see that I perhaps don't like. And there's a remembrance there, isn't there? For ourselves and for others. When I think about my own bad behaviour, my own bad speech, insensitive speech and sensitive gestures. Literally the stance with which we hold ourselves in life. It's like a gesture of being, isn't it? The way that we gesture with physicality, even to be with others. I can either move towards or away from. And so, what we are really attempting to do here is move towards. And all of these psychological foundations, including metta, move us towards things. If you think just about aversion, if you think about anger, irritation, resentment, what do? They make you go in the opposite direction, don't they? They turn you inwards, away from it, almost like a screen comes down. And so I don't see you, I see my anger about you. I see my resentment, I see my irritation. It's like, there might be a vague outline of you somewhere out there, but primarily what I see is what my lenses are that's there. And so what we're attempting to do, and again, please hear this in this way, I'm not having to like these things, but I'm making a movement which is a gesture of understanding, a gesture of kindness in many ways. Now, that doesn't always have to, when we hear those words, kindness and friendliness and that, sometimes it's friendlier and kinder to ourselves to do something that's difficult. And I would actually say meditation practice is like that, isn't it? Meditation practice is an incredibly kind thing to do to yourself, or do for yourself, perhaps is a better way of putting it. To do for yourself, to do, engage in that fundamental act of kindness of sitting still. You don't have to do anything. Sit still and let sound come to you. See what your responsiveness is to it. We elevate, meditation, I think, always makes it sound overinflated. It sounds like a big task. I'm going to do my meditation. It's a really practical, kind, friendly thing to do. But do we often want to do it? No. When I teach at places like Gaia House and in the interviews, it's one of the biggest questions I get asked is, how do I establish a day-to-day practice? Because I come to Gaia House, I do it for a certain, I do it for this week, I go away, I do it for another week, I do it for 3 days, no, I do it for 2 days, I do it for 1 day and then it disappears. And I come back to Gaia House again. or something like that. It's a reoccurring story, isn't it? How you sometimes don't do the very things which resource us. And so, if you like, just that fundamental act of friendliness and kindness towards yourself is sometimes to engage in something that's difficult, often difficult to fit into a schedule if you've got a busy life. But actually, shall I let you into a secret? There's probably time. Because we can find time for all sorts of things if we really, really think there's a payoff, don't we? So, in this particular instance, it's because we don't see an immediate payoff, not an immediate one, it's classed as being difficult. And so, we don't engage in that, again, fundamental act of kindness and friendliness towards ourselves because we, in a sense, haven't got a big enough investment in it to do it in many cases. And that's just an example that we will move towards something which we think is being friendly and kind to ourselves, which actually isn't, and shun the things that actually are. It's typical human perversity. Mm-hmm. Human beings are wonderfully perverse beings. So when we start to, if you like, just begin to touch and understand a little bit about metta, it actually affects every fundamental dimension of our practice and our lives. It means to engage much more fully, to see what really nourishes us, doesn't it? To see what really nourishes us in our lives. And of course it doesn't have to be just meditation. I mean, I'm not bizarre enough just to think that there's so many things that can nourish us, and it's getting that balance between some of these things, which are more difficult because they open us to the encounter with difficulty, and that, I think just is par for the course. I always get so incredibly crazy when doctors send people to relaxation, meditation centres for relaxation, and they still do it. Yet it's the encounter with the difficult. So when we begin to look at this, when we begin to examine this role, when we particularly look at it in relationship to ourselves, it's not an optional extra, is what I would say. Metta is not an optional extra. I hope I've made this clear right from the very beginning this morning. It's the heart of the practice. It really is the heart of the practice. I was sharing with the group yesterday, I was teaching, that there's a wonderful phrase by Michel Foucault, the French philosopher. He says that he talks about the ways of looking. And he says there is the cold eye which looks and cadaverizes life. And that's often what meditation can be, if it hasn't got metta within it. It simply kills things, stone dead. And I would actually suggest to you that you see that when you encounter the gaze of others, too, don't you? You know the objectifying gaze. Somebody who objectifies you. You know the gaze which helps you to open, to be more disclosive to somebody because it's restful, not demanding, not objectifying. And there is the inner gaze that we look at ourselves and where we can objectify. And that's actually where that self-critical stuff comes from, isn't it? We objectify ourselves. We turn ourselves into an object and look at ourselves harshly. And that's why it needs softening with metta. Like I can look at others and I can look at, God, look what you're doing. Phew, I wouldn't do that. We do that to ourselves, though, don't we? And if I begin to hold myself and my difficulties and my foibles, all the things, in a sense, sometimes I just want to push away and say, I don't like that about myself. When I begin to hold that in softer gaze, a gaze of metta, actually. So it's a way of looking. It's a way of hearing. Hence the listening exercise that we're engaged in today. It's a way of hearing, it's a way of looking, it's a way of seeing things. When we can begin to hold it in that softer gaze, ourselves, with, as I say, all our difficulties, all of our foibles, when I look at another who I don't necessarily like, perhaps it might soften my gaze towards them as well, in the way that I judge and perhaps criticize. Because often, as I suggested earlier on, when I understand that my own bad speech, bad behavior, arises out of often frustration, difficulty, pain, distress in my own life. In other words, using the Buddhist term about it, dukkha, when I know that it's arising out of dukkha because I've held it there, and I understand a lot of these behaviours are compensatory. Not always, but a lot of them are compensatory. When I know that, I can see sometimes, I don't have to approve of it, but it helps me understand that sometimes what others do, say, believe, actually comes out of their pain as well, comes out of their distress. And perhaps instead of being harsh, that might make me a little kinder towards them, because it comes out of a fundamental kindness towards my own pain and the behaviours that arise out of my own pain and difficulties in life. I could go on, as you probably gathered. But I think what we should do is perhaps, you know, I would say stand up for a few minutes. You've been sitting for quite a long period of time. Just give yourself a brief stretch.